Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never. And obviously, things have gotten a lot better, haven't they? Well, okay, sarcasm aside, I know there's tragedies. Tragedies occur every day. It doesn't have to necessarily come from a gun. Tragedies just are unfortunately, a part of our life. And as a matter of fact, I'll even go as far as to say that when tragedy comes at the hands of others, whether it be government or by loonies or what have you, it is just tragedy. It is tragic. So that's why they're tragedies. And so, obviously, politicians try to exploit these types of things. I think there's plenty of entertainers out there that are getting you to focus on all of those types of things. I want to dive deeper into what are the ills of our paradigms, the ills of our government, and which is why we dive into the Constitution. It's important that we start placing constitutional context to everything. Now, one of the things I want to dive into before I get back into the conspiracy as a part of this series, as you look at your measures, your bills, actually, I just call them bills because it's just a generic term, because in some places they may be a measure, initiative, it doesn't matter. If it's something that's going to become a tax, if it's something that's going to become law, where they're going to be able to levy tyranny upon you, it's a bill. And it's just, a bill is just a generic term for some type of legislation that is going to be enacted either by you, the voters, or by your legislatures within our government and so forth. So anyway, in Spokane, we have a bill on the ballot. It's called Measure One. And it has been supported by the GOP and is claimed to be a very good bill, which is why they're supporting it, and is approved as a conservative step forward. Now, I have to dive into this just a little bit. One of the reasons why, I'm not even going to mention names, but one of the reasons why this bill is embraced, and this is the justification that the Republican Party, and I'll just say Republican operators in the Spokane area say, well, the Democrats oppose this. Folks, if you vote based on the signaling of who you believe your opponent or the party that is your opponent party, and you're voting in that direction, if I knew that, then I would create all sorts of really bad bills and say we're against it in an area that's controlled by conservatives, and the conservatives just keep on voting for those things. And then I would lower the boom. That is no reason why. And so, actually, the real problem is this term conservative. Now, if we looked at this measure, this bill, which I'm going to get into just briefly, this is an unconstitutional bill. And I say that because as far as I am aware, social services are very limited, if at all, defined within the Washington State Constitution. And what this bill does is it's going to authorize the building of a sheriff's penal colony. Basically, it's building up a prison, but it looks like the majority of the money that is going to be used in the spending for this measure is for social services. Social services. Now, as far as I am concerned, within the Republican form of government that we're supposed to have, and when I look at how we're supposed to have a Republican form of government, not a socialist form of government, then states that actually are crossing that line, because the federal government has forced them to do this, they're actually they're actually violating that Republican form of government. But the real thing we need to expose here is, what does it mean to be conservative, and why people need to shift away from the quote-unquote conservative, close quote, organizations, politicians, entertainers, parties, anything that is labeled conservative. Because when we look at the conservative positions, they are conservative on the social side. They may appear to be moral on the social side. You know, we don't want abortion, so we want to create anti-abortion laws. When actually, what we do is we create a constitution, we delegate that power, and if the power within your constitution does not allow you to perform abortions or take lives of innocent infants or unborn children, then your state has no dog in the fight. In other words, your government has no involvement whatsoever. And this is why it needs to go down to the counties and let the counties kind of create their own constitutions to determine whether they're going to allow it at that level. Because it shouldn't even be decided at the state level. It's really a local issue. I mean, if you really have a group of godless people that say, we want to go ahead and start taxing people, they better be very careful. You know, taxing people to do all of these bad social services and so forth, they better be very, very careful, because they can easily cross that line to become oppressive, because that's exactly what they do. They become oppressive towards Christians and those of a religious nature. When I say religious nature, not the religious godless nature, but the religious nature of Christians, Jews, and so forth. And so... What you need to understand is that the Constitution demands a Republican form of government. And so when the Constitution was formed, social services were left to the people, the communities, and the churches, which is why every state in the Union had a direct relationship with the churches. They sponsored their church. They actually gave taxes. I was going to say tithes, but they actually gave taxes to their church to help support the social programs, the social needs. But it was not government's job. And now we have conservatives doing godless things in saying it's our job to allow the state to step in and start applying social programs and social services, when that should be done by the churches, not by the taxpayers. Anyway, there's a couple of other things I want to quickly try to go through. Obviously, Biden was talking about treaties. This actually feeds into, and I think it gives a really good highlight of why America has no business, no constitutional authority to create a foreign treaty so that we can actually be directly involved in not just supporting, but exploiting, using that treaty as a vehicle to exploit that foreign nation in controlling them, in holding them, you know, okay, if you don't do our bidding, then we're going to do this. We don't have any business, nor does the Constitution give our federal government the ability to do those types of things, folks. It's one thing to say we're going to have a treaty over war, we're not going to shoot at each other in military perspectives, or even in collecting maybe intelligence, because those two things are constitutional. But this other stuff, feeding them and compassionate services, I'm sorry, that's not within their realm. There's no power delegated to them to do that. Another really hot word, because I've suffered a little bit having to drive around doing some errands yesterday, and I noticed the trigger word with elections. People talked about the election and how, you know, this person, or I guess the new speaker, had spoke about the election was fraudulent and so forth. Folks, we don't have elections when it comes to the president. We have elections when it comes to our electors. In other words, if you read the Constitution, we choose our electors. Our electors choose the president. They are the ones that elect the president and the vice president separately. And so the fact is that they're getting away with using these types of terms. I mean, it's kind of funny. It's kind of ironic when I hear, you know, good people that, you know, I think their heart's in the right spot, and they hear somebody use the word democracy. They, oh, no, we are a Republican form of government, not a democracy. In other words, it's a trigger word for them. But all of these other little things are just completely slipping through their fingers, because when you understand that rule of law and the actual supreme law of the land, these other words should equally be a trigger, such as the election or overturning the election of the president. We do not elect the president. We elect our electors. Well, we're supposed to. But they're not letting you do that. And when I say they, I mean the parties. The parties aren't letting you do that. The parties are getting you to pay for them to control your elections. Isn't that nice? But that's the reality. Because you have primaries, who pays for that? The parties demand the primaries. It's not within the Constitution. And actually, primaries violate the Constitution. But guess what? It doesn't matter because you're paying for it. And isn't that great? Now, the last thing I want to bring up before we dive into the conspiracy, I'll just say kind of like the grand conspiracy. Biden is basically, you know, there's this virtue signaling we've heard before. And I believe that there's times when you can actually hear the allegiance of a person and how they go out of their way to cower. In other words, there's no doubt in my mind that Biden has played his hand, and he constantly plays his hand when it comes to China, that his allegiance, he constantly signals his allegiance to China when it comes down to whether we're, you know, because just yesterday, or maybe it was the day before, he was saying, no, we do not want to, we do not want or seek conflict, we want competition. And so those types of words basically, you know, goes down this path, because you hear other people talking about the right to sail, the right of navigation, that, you know, China doesn't have any legal standing to block our ability to traverse, you know, the water between Taiwan and China and so forth. And they're trying to do that. And so that right there by Biden would be conflict signaling, and there are people in his staff that hold that stand, but Biden himself cannot. So there's kind of this really iffy, where are we with China and what the heck is going on? Let me just say this. If China was ready to go to war, then Biden's position would be a lot different. And because China's not ready to go to war, and they do not want to expose the fact that they're not ready to go to war, Biden is basically buffering and buying them time so that they don't have to go to war. Now, I say this because going to war with the West is a big step. China has been building a navy. They've got a very big navy, but some of the capabilities that they have, I mean, they are seriously in the arms race. And they are seriously, what's so funny is the communists here in America give China a pass on their, what do they call that? Their colonization of the world, because that's exactly what they've been doing. They're colonizing it under the auspices of this new, beautiful communism that they're offering and instilling in all these different countries. Folks, I'm here to tell you that China is one of the most evil states. I've said this before, from their organ harvesting and so forth, and I'm expecting probably a little bit of denial of service or attacks or what have you from China, just due to the fact that we call them out. I know that everybody else calls them out in a controlled process, but I'm here to tell you folks that China wants war. They're pushing for war. They're just not ready for it. and they want to come across as this, you know, this, you don't unleash us. You don't want to unleash us now. Well, they don't want to be unleashed now, because the day that they're ready to go, they will go, and nothing's going to hold them back. And that, anyway, so that's it. There's a lot of other things I could go through. There's a lot of stuff that I can continue to go through. But what I really want to do is I want to kind of start connecting the dots on some of the stuff that we covered. Now, I already covered the fact that the Illuminati, that term, is an old and a religious term. And it is not a coincidence that there are such close parallels and or direct ties to religion when it comes to this conspiracy. Now, one of the things I mentioned, and I'm going to just say this before, because obviously I mentioned that when a bully has control over you and they lose control over you, they usually don't want to, let that go. They're not going to let it go without a fight. And more importantly, because we talked about this with gangs, gang and corruption behavior just seems to, on its own, it's almost like it's innate within the streets of government, any kind of government, gangs basically arise. I mean, what government in the world today does not have corrupt gangs? Is there some handbook of what do you do to make money when you don't want to get a job and you don't want to get educated? Because that's what gangs do. Gangs use force and intimidation. They go around their neighborhood and they intimidate people and say, we're here to protect you. And if you don't pay for our protection, then we're here to harass you, because then they destroy the store. As they get more and more organized, they become, dirtier and dirtier with their deeds. And so you get to a point where, you start killing people. There's no limit. There's no floor, I should say, when it comes to going down. It's just like the uncharted territory of going into space. When it goes to going to the low road, you can always find a lower point to get that road. And so what I want to convey is that when we split away from England, they weren't ready to let us go there. And they weren't going to let us go there. And they had the resources not to let us go. They did everything. They changed policies. They did what they needed to keep hooks in us. Now, let's back up a little bit. Because when we really look at, the big bully that actually took it on the chin, that big bully that was controlling the earth, because remember, the Roman Empire was a political organization that was controlling the world. And it was Constantine in, 330 or something like that, 230 AD, where he goes, these Christians over here, these guys are willing to die for their religion, but we can't get Romans to die for our raw. And so, we need to integrate Christianity. And over this battle of some bridge, all of these things I forget, but the facts are they're there. That when you look at what he did, he basically hijacked Christianity and integrated it, and then made all sorts of decisions based on how it would serve the Roman Empire moving forward. So he created a pope, and he appointed the first pope, and so forth. And over time, as the Roman Empire became more and more corrupt, and literally corrupt, and the Catholic Church kind of severed their relationship, or the Roman Catholic Church severed their relationship as the Roman Empire crumbled, and they maintained this control over the world. They were continuing to coronate the kings, and so it was through this religious process where they were controlling governments. Now, we've already talked about Martin Luther. We've talked about how, you know, states literally one by one started breaking away after Martin Luther successfully broke away from the Catholic Church. Now, we never talk much about the details about, you know, what happened and how things move forward. But let me ask you something. Do you really believe that if the Catholic Church was that corrupt and that controlling, that they just, oh, you know what, they got us there, we're going to let them go? You really believe that they let the Protestants go? You really believe that they let the, you know, England go? The Catholic Church, you know, there were points in time where they had these things called the Spanish Inquisition, where, you know, they would actually go and try to keep people from basically defecting from the church. And I am here to tell you that the Catholic Church maintained their hooks one way or the other. They had people on the inside reporting and trying to drive and use influence in making sure that the churches, these new independent churches, didn't go too far. And so when we really look at, you know, how, you know, a large empire, when it falls, does it really fall? Unless it was destroyed. And so when we look at empires, or I should say, when we look at these types of conflicts in the old history books, you know, the unique thing about Israel was when they took down their enemy, they took them down. And there was nothing left. They didn't, you know, care to manipulate or be involved in the fragments. I mean, Saul was commanded to kill even the chickens and their livestock. So when we look at, you know, that approach, why is it that, you know, when there's a revolution like the Martin Luther Revolution, why is it that that went down the way it did? Because I believe the Catholic Church was looking at saying, you know what, okay, we can't stop this, and we don't want to necessarily have a real bad press of having a war. Using manipulation, using intelligence, and those types of intrigue is the way to go. So this concept of intrigue, spies, operatives, and so forth, it's as old as man. And so to think that, you know, everything has just been autonomous, you know, we need to start thinking again. And we need to really start looking at what really went down and so forth. Now, let me get back to where we left off. Where we left off, and I got less than a minute, and we're going to go into break. Where we left off, we were talking about the song Jerusalem. And, you know, I actually went through the words because here is a hymn. This is basically like a holy song that speaks to this religious folklore, and literally it's folklore, that was kind of spread. And I'm going to dive into that folklore when we come back, because it is this superstition, these types of things that bring people together over a pretense of something good, something important, right? If that makes sense, because a lot of times getting people to rise to something that's greater than themselves is a way you can actually motivate them in doing things, which is, if you really look at what I'm trying to get you to do in using petitions and actually going after our politicians and holding them accountable, that is something that's greater than one of us. It is about getting everybody to do that. So these are common tactics of, let's just call them movements, warfare, whatever you want to call it. But let me go into the break, and when we come back, I'll dive into this legend.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.
As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so the folklore is this, and the Bible kind of accounts for the fact that the young man Jesus, before he started his ministry, traveled around, and apparently he traveled around with Joseph of Arimathea. Now, I believe, I'm pretty sure, this is the same Joseph that gave his tomb to Christ for Christ to be buried. Now, apparently, he was also a sailor and a trader. And the line in Jerusalem, the quote-unquote feet in the line, and those feet in ancient time refers to Jesus. And one of the most famous legends about Joseph's time in Glastonbury states, and again, this is a legend, states that one night Joseph struck his staff into the ground and went to sleep. And when he awoke, he saw that a hawthorn tree had miraculously sprung from the staff, and that the holy thorn survived until it was cut down as a relic of superstition by the puritanical roundheads during the Civil War. Now, when we talk about the Civil War, not the American Civil War, we're talking about the holy, or I should say the glorious Civil War of Britain. It was replaced by the local council twice, and in the 1950s, only to be hacked down again with a chainsaw 6 years ago. So no one is really sure why they've done that, but there's this little, you know, mystery about this old relic of a tree, this hawthorn tree. Now, there's a professor, give him some creds here, Diarmond McCullough, the professor of the Church of History at the University of Oxford. Now, just what I said, professor of church history at the University of Oxford describes the legend. Now, you remember, this is the Anglican Church, right? That was the state church of England, still is. Now, the University of Oxford, and he describes the legend as, quote-unquote, totally implausible. It obviously didn't happen. Why should a carpenter's son from the Eastern Mediterranean even think to come here? It's just silly English self-promotion, nothing more to it than that. Now, I'm not here to determine whether it's true or not. You know, I'm not here to say, oh, well, this is a superstition. I will say it has become superstition. There's a lot of people that are basing everything, you know, the importance of England, that the New Jerusalem will be built there, based on, you know, information that one isn't scripture and it's just too questionable. So anyway, at the beginning of the 19th century, now back to this whole point of when this song was coming forth. This was after Britain had just took it on the chin from the American colonies, where we became a autonomous United States and literally had our independence. There are people out there that are claiming, just like a lot of other superstition, that America was actually subjugated by the crown under the Constitution and that we were paying them. Show me the records of that. Show me how there were outlays in the budget where that money, because they accounted for where all the money went. And I'm telling you, that would have been, you know, huge. Anybody, I mean, there were way too few people that were in government that were had any loyalties. I mean, Hamilton clearly had some Anglophile tendencies, but he himself, you know, was a very ardent anti-British crown and actually supported the removal of the Tories. So I see the American government at that point in time under the Constitution, as we just formed this new Constitution, as pure and clean as could possibly ever be. We had people that had avarice and, you know, they had, you know, ulterior motives, but none had any alliances to the crown. And when America, or I should say, the Constitution of the United States was established, it was established on the principles of liberty and autonomy from all other nations and entanglements. So, again, back to the beginning of the 19th century, there was a common phrase that was used in describing the English Empire, and it was said that the sun never set on the English Empire because they ruled the world. Well, except for these several states that we had, but they did have colonies around the world. So by this time, the beginning of the 19th century, the British crown, whether you knew this or not, had an army of intelligence operators. Now, when I say intelligence operators, you know, you can consider your press, your news people, your journalist as an operator of intelligence, because what do? They go out and they report what they're seeing. And it's not like this is clandestine stuff. This is stuff that's actually out in the open so that the crown knows everything. And so there was this large army of operators that we'll just call commonly, you know, open agents. I mean, these people were openly working under the employ of a British company, Britain, or what have you. And there was this basic reporting, and you could call it news. But it was the information necessary for the crown to know what was going on around the world. And this was very, very big because Britain did have, and they were the largest and the single most, I'll just say, when it came to the news or what we call, you know, the news back in those days or the press, England was the epitome of that as far as collecting information and reporting it so that the commoners kept apprised. And the crown knew what was going on. And so these agents were working for the crown's interest out in the open. And in other words, non-clandestine, I'm trying to get these words right here, non-clandestine operations. In other words, they weren't actually, you know, spying, listening in, and getting information that wasn't public. Now, that doesn't mean that they didn't have that. As a matter of fact, the crown also had, if you want to call it a smaller clandestine collections apparatus. You know, absolutely they did, but it wasn't small in comparison to, you know, what we would consider, because you got to look at this English Empire as a very huge thing. It had co-opted and got all sorts of people around the world, India, folks, China, they were everywhere. Okay, so keep in mind that, you know, even though this was a smaller clandestine apparatus, they were doing things that the crown would actually deny. In other words, these people were out there, and if all of a sudden they were caught, you know, in listening or what have you, in spying, the Crown would absolutely deny it. Plausible deniability was alive and well long before it became a popular term. So keep in mind, they had agents and operatives, both clandestine and open, in the West Indies Trading Company, in a lot of these different companies that the Crown controlled. Remember, every single colony was established by a charter, a legal charter, with the king or the queen, whoever the monarch of the time was when that colony was established. And so there were these feeders of open information and secret information that kept on coming back. And as we look at, you know, building up, and actually, you know, prior to the 19th century, at the end of the 18th century, when we were going through the Revolutionary War, most people may not know this. I don't know if you know, but George Washington, through his training in the British Army, I'm sorry, he understood the importance of intelligence operations. He actually used intelligence gathering in the Revolutionary War, and he used it in his administration as president. So I'm here to tell you that intelligence, a lot of people look at spying as something that is, you know, not constitutional. It is constitutional because it's a part of our national security, of trying to understand what the subtext of what's going on in that country, and even greater subtext of things that we don't even know. So post-Revolutionary War, you know, we realized that Britain had these operatives in America. Now, we kicked a lot of these people out. So Britain had to go around and basically recruit or bring in new people as, you know, as either potential citizens of the United States or operators, businessmen, what have you. Because, again, they had open operators, which were businessmen and or journalists or what have you. And then they also had these, you know, these secret spies. So when we look at the post-Revolutionary War, you got to think again, just like the Catholic Church or just like any great empire, they're not about to let a snot-nosed government like the American government that is standing up and trying to evolve to succeed. Britain was hell-bent to drag us back into their arms and make an example of us, because if we got away with what we did, then other colonies might try to revolt against them as well. Because they weren't about ready to change the way they were dealing with colonies. You know, it had served them for hundreds of years, and as far as they're concerned, they wanted to perpetuate it. So when we look at, you know, the post-American Revolutionary War, the Revolutionary War, then we actually see that Britain, you know, some of the contentions that they had with our treaty was kind of, I mean, it was pretentious for the most part, because when we actually exiled all of these British Tories or the British loyalists in America, we took their property. And Britain, this had happened while we were going through the treaty, and that became a primary point for Britain. And it was, to me, you know, it's like hyperbole. They were using that as, how dare you talk about property rights and then take the rights of these people? You know, they were basically poking us in the eye, being hypocrites and so forth. And so they weren't about to just let that go. So they used that as their excuse, because they had to come up with something that they, you know, were going to justify not abiding by the treaty. Now, I've also seen the nationalists and these anti-constitutionalists go out and say, you know, every conquering nation actually does the treaty on their own soil. You know, that's not true. And as a matter of fact, sometimes, you know, there's reasons why we actually go across the nation. It had nothing to do with this fact that we were subjugated. You know, when we had multiple players in the Revolutionary War, the reason why the Treaty of Versailles was there is because we had French interests involved in that treaty because France had invested heavily and Holland. So when we started looking at the treaty, this treaty was more of a European treaty, which is why we were basically there. Now, does it mean that in later treaties, like the Treaty of Versailles after World War II, that was, you know, a nefarious treaty? Absolutely. Because there were deals that were being done that had nothing to do with ending that war. But the men of the time, Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, and I believe John Jay, were the three men that were attending the initial treaties with Britain. You know, there's no doubt in my mind that these men were actually taking care of American interest. And for somebody to come along and say, oh, no, you know, that was nefarious, we were subjugated. Show me the evidence. Show me the evidence. So as we kind of acknowledge the fact that Britain was going to do anything they could, and they defined this taking of the property of the loyalists that were sent out or sent back to Britain without anything, they used that as their number one contention. And so this is how they were going to continue to actually not honor that treaty. It finally came up, and I'll just say it this way, even though it wasn't really a coup d'etat, it was one of those things that was used to basically try to drag us back under Britain, the War of 1812. Now, when they attacked us, they were taking it to us. They burnt down D.C. In all terms, when you look at the warfare and the conflict, when we were heading into that treaty, we were pretty well defeated. And most people would say, well, they basically conquered us back again, but they actually didn't. This is when they realized that they couldn't, because at the same time, they had already received intelligence that Andrew Jackson in the South kicked their butts. And that they were, you know, that America was going to be able to succeed militarily with whatever Britain could throw at them. And they came with everything they had in all of these different directions. And when we started actually turning the tide of the war, I think that's why they finally said, okay, we're going to honor this treaty. We can't afford to basically keep poking or kicking the dog, because this dog is going to turn around and bite us. So what they had to do was they had to commit to doing the next best thing, which would be to subvert us. Now, how did they learn about subversion? They had to have learned that the Catholic Church was doing what it could and it trying to subvert the British crown when they moved away from the Catholic Church and created their own. When the Anglican Church started coronating the king and there was this complete division and the falling away from the Catholic Church of the Anglican Church. You know, one of the things I like to tell people, you know, when you really look at people that break away, you know, it's almost like a child that breaks away from the family. There's always those relationships, those ties, that, you know, that family genetics and so forth, that down the road, those ties come back together. And we're starting to see the Catholic Church actually trying to religiously reassemble those who fell away, the Protestants, the Anglicans, and so forth. Britain had committed to doing the next best thing, which was to basically divide and conquer us. And you have to understand, using division and conquering is one of those things that has to be done in series. In other words, you have to basically divide and conquer, this degree, whether it be political or what have you. And that's exactly what they did. When you really look at how they started dividing us, they actually started dividing us and exploiting us due to the fact that we were growing quickly And it's really hard to control your growth. I mean, if you're just, people are pouring into America, you're growing your states, you're moving westward. All of a sudden, this term called manifest destiny and this America grew based on those same kind of moral principles that we needed to do this. Just like what Britain was doing, they needed to do it. I mean, this was just common. This is why the laws of nations basically felt that it was a moral thing for Western society to spread Christianity. That's what they were supposed to do. Now, as we moved away from the laws of nations, well, actually, there's still laws of nations out there. These are these treaties and so forth. America did its best in trying to honor and live up to the laws of nations as we were conquering the West. But there were players and parties that actually did bad things. And Jackson was one of them. Anyway, the one issue the Britain first seized the opportunity in dividing us was the slavery issue. And they basically helped develop the party system. And the division in America was one to weaken us. Because we actually started seeing how the Federalists and the Anti-Federalists, and at that point in time, it wasn't Britain that was involved in the Federalist and, I should say, the Republican Party in the early 1790s. That was really Americans becoming divided over the direction of government. And the revolution, or I should say the coup that Jefferson and Madison successfully did, took us back onto the right track. So Britain, understanding that there was this problem that was actually coming to surface, slavery, they started exploiting. At this point in time, they had no real deep penetration. But the one thing that they actually were penetrating, because they weren't penetrating the politics or government seats itself, but they were leaning and pushing towards a division in party with the Democrats. Because at this point in time, in 1820, the Republicans were the only party. We needed a new party. So they helped spur a party over slavery, which was the Democratic Party. Now, when we start looking at, you know, this control that, you know, slavery actually took over in this nation and some of the unconstitutional things happened, Britain at this point, they still weren't effectively playing us. But over time, they started figuring out how to exploit and how to start growing. I will tell you that the Department of Home had nothing to do with, even though it was unconstitutional. This is one of the points I like making. When you look at some of the things that were done, they weren't done because of this grand conspiracy, like the creation of the Department of Home. The creation of the Department of Home, which is what we call the Department of Interior, that was created in 1849, it was done as kind of like a noble gesture. At this point in time, we saw that the growth of the Union was pretty much dying. And, you know, it was done. What was farther to the west was the Pacific Ocean. There was no more land to conquer. There was no more land to just migrate to. So the migration was done. The forming of the boundaries of America was done. And they realized that the need to have all of these people employed was going to be done with. But if they created the Department of Home and gave them, you know, additional responsibilities, and this became the justification of them trying to keep and maintain land. At no point in time, I do not see any connection towards the British operatives in America. The British operatives in America were actually working in the legal system in trying to establish, and I'm trying to remember when the establishment, I think it was in the 1870s when the American Bar Association was finally established. But it was apparent in America that in the early 1800s, the British legal lawyer system was starting to come, and this is why the 13th Amendment actually got ratified. When I say the 13th Amendment in 1812 was ratified, and that was one that refers to, and we're going to cover this coming week, so I'm not going to go into it now. But when you look at what the 13th Amendment did, it made it so that if anybody became a part of the English bar, the British bar, the B in the bar is Britain, British. And so if any lawyer became a part of that, became an esquire, they were, I believe, we'll get into it, they could no longer be a citizen and they were not allowed to serve in office without the consent of Congress. So, you know, we saw them penetrating and getting into and creating this class within America. So, in other words, their real foot coming into America that kind of seemed open as well as secretive was our legal system for lawyers, politicians, politics, all of that. They were using the legal process to come into America. So there's no doubt that Britain was working with the fabric of our society, and it took a while for them to actually start crossing over into other fabrics. But before the Civil War, by that time, the American people were too good to overthrow, to allow an overt attempt to control us. In other words, there was just no way they could openly revolt against America. They had to subvert us and control us from, you know, the closed, you know, backroom doors of, you know, secrecy and so forth. And so by the time we were going in, and when I say we were good, America was a very moral and just nation. And again, the British bar at that point in time, or the American Bar Association, was established. Now, when you look at the establishment of the American bar, that doesn't mean that it wasn't organized before then. Nine times out of ten, an organization starts growing when they get to a point where they've been accepted and people just don't understand what they are, what's going on. You know, okay, well, you know, so they're everywhere anyway. Why don't we allow them to become this American Bar Association? Because they have that high a number. In other words, it's almost like a mosque. You have to have so much penetration into the area to where you can use enough, let's just say, social pressures to say, we deserve a mosque or we deserve our own bar. And that's how it played out. And so going into the Civil War, Britain was getting ready to actually establish the bar, or I should say people here, operatives, were at that point. And so we went into the war on the pretenses. Now, so actually, I'm going to kind of stop myself because I've got 20 seconds. We went into that war on the pretense that, you know, we had to basically stop slavery, but it was an economic issue, not a slavery issue. The South seceded on slavery, but Lincoln basically pushed this fact that they couldn't secede. You know, it was an economic issue. He wasn't going to allow it to fail or allow America to fail. So when we come back, we will dive into the Civil War and how it played, created the stage for the undermining of our government. And so with that, I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
To become a citizen, one must take an oath to support and defend the Constitution. Those of us who are naturally born citizens are obligated and duty-bound to fulfill the same oath, even though we're not required to take it, because it is implied upon us at birth. This is why I cannot emphasize enough the importance in supporting businesses who are supporting our Constitution. We have to stop supporting businesses that have chosen to hide behind political correctness, and obviously we must stop supporting progressive businesses who are working to undermine our republic and our Constitution. Do not let businesses or organizations convince you that they are supporting the Constitution by supporting protests for social justice. By definition, social justice is the distribution of wealth, opportunities, and privileges within a society. In other words, they're calling for socialism, which is incompatible with individual liberty and individual sovereignty and our Constitution. With that, please consider supporting businesses who advertise on this show and this radio station.